Hey guys, it's me, Jesse. I think you're really going to like this show, but I wanted to chime in here and remind you that right now is the Max Fun Drive. Once a year, we ask for your money to pay for this show. I know that if you listen to a podcast, it's because you chose to do so. There are no casual podcast listeners, only people who affirmatively subscribed to the show and continue to listen every week. If you value what we're doing, visit MaximumFun.org/donate and give right now. I'll be back to bother you a little bit more later, but here's the show.
I'm Jesse Thorne, live on tape from my house in Los Angeles. It's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program, Walter Mosley, is the author of more than 30 books in his 20-some-odd year career. He's probably best known for the E.Z. Rollins mystery, starting with his first published book, Devil in a Blue Dress, at the end of the 1980s, and continuing to his newest book with a new protagonist, Known to Evil. He's written in genres including detective fiction and crime fiction, but also science fiction and nonfiction and literary fiction. He's written a play, and he even wrote a book of what we will call adult fiction for the purposes of public radio. Walter, welcome to The Sound of Young America. Well, it's great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
We're here in Los Angeles where we record the show, and I guess I didn't know that you are originally from Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah. Born and raised.
My dad spent his teenage years in Glendale. He's maybe 5 years older than you are. And when he comes down here, his eyes are always like, you know, saucers because he can't believe the way that the place has transformed in that 40 years. In a way that, like, I'm from San Francisco, and I think maybe, you know, different people will be living in San Francisco 30 years from now, but it'll look largely the same.
Yeah. Well, Los Angeles has grown in population 100,000 people a year, every year since 1945.
And that's a lot of hundreds of thousands of people.
That's a lot of hundreds of thousands of people. It's millions and millions of people. It's big.
What was the Los Angeles that you grew up in? You sort of had a pre-adolescence in South LA, and then moved around adolescence. Am I remembering that right?
Well, I lived in Los Angeles until I was 18 or 19, and then left. So, you know, I was born and raised till the age of 12 in Watts, and then moved over to West-ish Los Angeles, Fairfax and Pico. And, you know, and there I was. You know, I lived here till 1973, I think, and then I was gone.
What kind of place was Watts when you were a kid? How do you remember it?
You know, it's funny when you talk to me about your father because, you know, most of Los Angeles hasn't changed at all. And there's a lot more people. But when you go to all the old places, you know, all the bungalows that were, you know, that existed when I was a little kid, they're still there. Bungalows are still there. The buildings are still there. The streets are pretty much the same. That's why the traffic is so bad. It is the Los Angeles I remember to a great degree. And it's funny. You know, I know the big difference for me is the black population has mostly moved out to outlying areas. But I recognize Los Angeles.
When you were 18 and you moved out of Los Angeles, was it because you were the kind of 18-year-old that wanted to get out of the place that you grew up?
Yeah, I wanted to get as far away from it as possible, so I moved to Vermont.
That's pretty far.
In every way possible, it was different. It was very cold. It was very north. It was very, you know, very white.
I read somewhere a claim that you had a Bay Area and Santa Cruz period.
Well, you know, I would, you know, I'm from Los Angeles, so I go up to Santa Cruz all the time. I go up to San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley all the time. I mean, I feel very connected. At the end of this book tour that I'm on, I'm going to spend 5 days in San Francisco.
I went to college in Santa Cruz.
Uh-huh. UC Santa Cruz.
At UC Santa Cruz, and I'm counting up, doing the math in my head. I would imagine that the time that you spent in Santa Cruz
was really at just, hippie cultural revolution central time.
Yeah.
How did you identify yourself culturally in that period when all these categories were kind of exploding outward, you know, in this big sort of cultural shift?
You know, it's so interesting in America. America, you are defined culturally. You don't really define yourself culturally. You know, I was a guy, you know. I was living my life and happy to be living my life. I was, you know, certainly black, certainly Jewish, certainly, you know, a hippie, certainly young, you know. I mean, there was all these things that I was. But, you know, I don't know. I don't feel that they were, like, overriding definitions except externally. You know, internally, I was Walter.
Did you have an idea of something that you wanted to do with your life besides
I still don't.
That sort of exploration?
I still don't. I mean, the idea of doing something with your life. One of the things I love about being from California is you can think about things like that, but you don't have to. And, you live your life. You know, that's what you do. You live your life. And that's what's wonderful. It's what's wonderful. The idea of actually doing something, you know, it's always going to be as negative as it is positive. And so you're always going to be answerable for all the best things you've done.
And now, at the same time, you have since the, you know, mid to late 1980s written so many books that I cannot imagine that your lifestyle is anything but profoundly committed to writing books. So what was the difference between you in, you know, 1971 hitchhiking across the country, and getting high all the time, and you in, 1986 decided to write every day?
I didn't get high anymore, but, I don't think there's a lot of difference. Honestly, really, honestly, I just don't think there's a lot of difference. I've always, you know, obsessively been working at something. I drew, and I still draw for a long time. I get up every day and I draw for 3 hours. And then when I start writing, I stop drawing and I start writing for 3 hours. You know, it's something, you know, that you like doing. I mean, hippies weren't lazy. They did things, you know, they just, you know, the idea, but those things didn't necessarily connect to to an ambition or a goal. You know, I like writing very much. I like writing novels, and I think that my novels get better, and I feel, you know, just love it, you know. But it's like my book, you know, this year you write your novel, you know. It's just simple. This year you write your novel, you know. You know, it's nothing about ambition or career or money or even sales or publication. It's just like, well, you do what you like to write a novel. I love writing. I think it's a great thing to do, and I do it.
When you started writing, was it really not tied to ambition? And I'm not just talking about, like,
absolutely not
career ambition, but it's hard to get through.
Well, I had the ambition to write a finished story. I remember that very clearly. I wanted to write a story that had a first line and a last line, and when you read the first line all the way to the last line, it made sense. That's what I wanted to be able to do, and, you know, ultimately I did it.
Production of The Sound of Young America is supported in part by the Calgary Folk Festival, 4 days of musical concerts and collaborations in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. 68 artists perform in an urban park July 22nd through 25th, including the Avett Brothers, St. Vincent, Michael Franti, and Roberta Flack. More information online at calgaryfolkfest.com. By Humber College, offering a 2-year program dedicated to comedy. Students learn stand-up, improv, acting, and writing skills and perform in the heart of Toronto. At Humber, we make funny people funnier. More information at humbercomedy.com. And by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com. Hey gang, it's me, Jesse. I hope you're enjoying the show. I tried to get some really awesome stuff for our Max Fun Drive. I don't know if you know this, but this is the 10th year of The Sound of Young America. We started this show in 2000 in a college radio station in Santa Cruz. Jordan and Gene and I literally had to go to the station before the shuttle buses on the UCSC campus started running. So we had to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, which is no mean feat for college guys. and walk across the campus, often in the dark, in the damp, under the trees, literally through the woods, to get to the radio station to make the show. 10 years later, I am no less committed to making an amazing program for you. But I need to ask you to be committed to us. Making the Sound of Young America is expensive. I do a huge amount of work and, you know, I have to pay my rent and pay for the studio, which, granted, is a second bedroom in my apartment. We pay Nick, the editor, to edit this show. In fact, he's probably editing what I'm doing right now. We pay for studios all over the world. We pay for travel to places like Sundance and South by Southwest, where we can gather awesome people. We run an incredibly efficient operation here. There's no waste. A lot of other shows that are like ours have 4 or 5 producers. We've got me hosting, producing, etc., 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 plus Nick working 2 days a week out of his apartment in Chicago and a part-time intern. Every penny of what you give us makes an impact. So if you value what we do, visit MaximumFun.org/donate and give. You can give us $10 a month, $20 a month. It's a small drop in the bucket of your monthly income, but it makes a huge difference to us here. MaximumFun.org/donate. Let's return to the show. It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Walter Mosley, is one of the nation's most acclaimed mystery novelists. His newest book is Known to Evil.
How did you fall into the specific sort of genre world of writing detective fiction?
Yeah, I had written a story about E.Z. Rollins, Gone Fishing. Nobody wanted to publish it because it was about 2 young black men in the Deep South who weren't particularly educated. There were black women in the story, but those black women weren't central characters, and the kind of reigning theory at that time was, white people don't read about black people, black women don't like black men, and black men don't read, so who's going to publish your book? And so then I wrote about the same two characters, Mouse and Easy. I wrote a mystery, and it got published.
What did you like about working in a world that has such established conventions, that has a sort of a system where you're sort of working both with and against this kind of setup that comes with what you're doing?
I never thought about it. You know, I was writing stories and I'm writing novels and I put them out there in the world. The other day I sent a collection of stories to my editor and he said, well, you know, I don't really get it. So I said, okay. So now I'm going to publish them somewhere else. You know, I mean, I'm not concerned with the structures because I know that the structures are trying to maintain something that was, and there are other things that are becoming. The work might not be good, that's true, and I might fail at something, that's true, but it doesn't really matter. You never succeed if you don't fail.
You know, I was reading the new book Known to Evil, and it was reminding me of something about the E.Z. Rollins books, many of which I read. Which was that one of the biggest differences between your detective fiction and much detective fiction. I know I've read you describing this new stuff as hard boiled, but it's a sort of on a relative scale. Is that a lot of detective fiction is about someone who has been completely like cut loose from the world and society and normal strictures, and thus like has to establish his own idea of what's important. That's usually like solving the case. Somebody who kind of like, you know, lives in a sort of liminal place. And both Leonid McGill and E.Z. Rollins are both very deeply rooted in family in different ways. But the books are about as much about their relationship with their families as they are about, you know, them out in the world solving
absolutely
the mystery.
Yeah.
How do you think that came to be so important in these books?
Well, you know, the hard-boiled and noir fiction are both blue-collar existentialist literature. you have existentialist heroes, people who are looking to do the right thing in the world and trying to figure out what the right thing is in a world where it's almost, almost all the rules have turned topsy-turvy. My characters, the old characters, the way that they made them existentialist to give them no mother, no father, no sister, no brother, no friends, no girlfriend, no wife, no children, no dog.
All they have is a stiff drink.
They change an apartment every month, right? So, like, if they got into trouble, like, for instance, if a detective, if the policeman go to a detective and said, "You got to turn this guy in," he says, "No, I'm not going to do it." And they say, "Well, we'll put you in jail until you do." He says, "Well, I don't care. Do it." Of course he doesn't care because he has no responsibilities. When you add the issue of, you know, family and connections and community connections and then say that to him, then the decision becomes much more, much greater pressure. Don't get me wrong. I think that, you know, Hammett and Chandler and Ross McDonald, the early greats, did a wonderful job creating these characters. And their eyes and their vision of the world is really extraordinary. But at the same time, to do that today, you go a little easy on your characters. Well, okay, fine. So you don't have to do anything. You don't owe anybody anything. So you can do whatever you want. So what difference does that make? You can say, if you do this, but you still have, you know, children at home, a dog that hasn't been fed in 18 hours or walked, then that's another issue.
You also have, with both Lena McGill, the protagonist of your newest book, and E.Z. Rollins, family relationships that are much more complicated than the traditional, and not just, you know, complicated romantic relationships with their wives, although, you know, a big part of this book is the protagonist sort of struggling to figure out what his relationship with his wife is, but also like these really complicated relationships with kids. And it was the same way with E.Z. Rollins. It's sort of like, you know, one of the key characters of this one is a kid who isn't the protagonist's natural child,
mm-hmm.
but who the protagonist freely admits is his favorite of his children.
Right. Twill. Yeah.
Why do you think you like to complicate that so much?
Well, you know, I think that the normal family, the regular family, the accepted family doesn't exist. I think that we all have very complicated relationships all throughout our lives, and that my book is just talking about that. I think Leonid McGill's relationship to his family is not standard, but neither do I think it's unusual.
E.Z. Rollins moved through time sort of in a similar way to, like, you know, the way August Wilson's plays move through time. His mm-hmm. life kind of played out over the course of the books as set against, you know, these various historical periods. These most recent two Leonid McGill books are contemporary.
Yes.
But they're also, I think, Middle Age is a really important part of
yeah.
Leonid McGill.
Yeah.
There's this part where a character says, "When you hit your 50s, life starts coming up on you fast," Gordo Tallman said to me on the occasion of my 49th birthday. "Before that time, life is pretty much a straight climb. Wife looks up to you, and the young kids are small enough, and the older kids are smart enough not to weigh you down. But then, just when you start putting on pounds and losing your wind, the kids are expecting you to fulfill your promises, and the wife all of a sudden sees every single one of your flaws. Your parents, if you still got any, are getting old and turning back into kids themselves. For the first time, you realize that the sky does have a limit. You come into a rise, but when you hit the top, there's another life up ahead of you, and there you are, just about spent." Was getting to a point like that in your own life part of why you wanted to create a protagonist who was at a point like that in his life?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know.
Is that really the honest answer? Really?
No, I don't know. I mean, I like that part that you just read.
Do you relate to that?
I don't necessarily relate to it. No, I don't. I don't feel that. I look with great expectation to that second phase of my life, and I know that Leonid has a very negative view of it because of the amount of work that he has to do, and he doesn't feel that he can. You know, it is fiction. You know, I mean, I am, you know, I'm older than Leonid. He's 54. I'm 58. But still, no, I don't feel the same way, but I revel in writing about it.
No, what do you think you like about writing about it?
It sounds true. It feels true to me. It feels right to me. It feels like what most Americans experience. They experience all, you know, it's like, especially that thing, you know, about like, you know, the whole time your wife has loved you and all of a sudden she sees all your flaws, you know. It's really like things stop working at a certain time, you know. Everything that you expected, everything that you thought was going to go on, stops. And you have no more control over it. And the one thing you have to do is kind of relinquish control and just do the best you can.
That's a very sort of existential crisis right
well,
there.
Well, but there, this is an existential genre, I believe.
I live in, when I read that, the thing that struck me was fear for the day that my wife would recognize all of my flaws.
Or you could look forward to it. You know, that's the other thing, you know. One of the interesting things about life is that, you know, when things change, there's a potential for them to get better. And that's the way I've always felt, that no matter what goes wrong, no matter what you lose, no matter what hurts you, if it doesn't kill you, there's a possibility for your life to get better. And but you have to be able to see the opportunities.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be on The Sound of Young America. It was great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Walter Mosley's great new novel is Known to Evil, a Leonid Mgil mystery. It's only the latest in a string of now 34 books that span all genres and styles. Thanks again, Walter.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Jesse one last time. I hope you enjoyed that show. I certainly enjoyed making it. You know, it's your support that allows us to make this program. We've been making The Sound of Young America for 10 years. This is our 10th anniversary, and we couldn't do it without you. 3 years ago, I was still working a part-time job to support my, I don't know what you'd call it, maybe Sound of Young America habit. I think that in that 3 years, not only has my work grown to a full-time job, or frankly more than a full-time job, but I think the show has grown along with it. If you ask me, the future of media is independent, and you have a chance to cast a vote in favor of independent media. Look, we give out our shows for free. Every single one of our programs, the whole six-year archive of podcasted shows are absolutely for free on our website and in iTunes, and we don't begrudge anyone downloading them for free. But what we do ask is that when they do, if they like them, if you care about them, you support us. So, visit MaximumFun.org/donate. You can check out some of the cool thank you gifts that we've got, including some exclusive t-shirts and our awesome, exclusive to this pledge drive, Sound of Young America Live in New York DVD with some great Jordan Jesse Go content on it, too. There's lots of good reasons to give. But what's most important is that you get up off of your good intentions and visit MaximumFun.org/donate right now. MaximumFun.org/donate. And my thanks to those of you who've already given. Make sure to bother your friends who listen. Twitter, tweet, blog about this Maximum Fun Drive May 13th to May 28th so we can get as many people to give and support this operation as is possible. That's MaximumFun.org/donate. Thanks, friends.